Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Tuesday, November 1st, 2022. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of the book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 18 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, download it, print it off as often as you'd like, and use it over and over again absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And if you choose to do that, before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you choose to tap on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app. The app contains the Reality Management Worksheet. It contains an abbreviated version of that worksheet process. And it contains a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. And we hope people do all of that soon and often because it tends to improve the quality of people's lives as they engage the use of these tools. It also tends to promote comments, questions, answers, and testimonials. If you have any of those to share with us, please give us a call at 563-999-3581. If you call that number, 563-999-3581, and press 1 on your phone, it will put the little icon of a hand by your phone number, and I can turn on the microphone and announce you by your area code, and we can have a conversation. We appreciate when people do that because it makes it far easier for us to live into our intention with this work. The intention we have with this work is to be a service. So if you have a way that we can be a service to you, comments, questions, answers, or testimonials, please share them with us. You can also do you can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org. And you can email Jeannie at jeannie@whyagain.org, whyagain.org. And if you're not able to call in live or choose not to call in live, you can email us. We'll address your comment or question on the internet show, and then as time allows, send you an email that lets you know what day and time we addressed it so you can go back into the archives and listen to the comments. So, We have time. The second hour today will be something on communication from Michael and Jeannie. They're traveling today, so they will not be live. But this first hour is live, and we can dive back into any comment or question someone might have, or we can go back into our reading of The Way of Mastery. Yesterday we began reading the lesson 26, and trying to understand what it takes for us to get a more accurate picture of our true nature and our role in the world. How is life unfolding? And we left off yesterday with the beginning of the next heading is giving up the game of seeking. And the text reads, finding is the same as resting in knowledge. Finding is the same as Christ consciousness. And the same as perfect peace. Finding requires giving up the game of seeking. Such a one cannot be known by the minds of the world. Such a one walks in the world, but inwardly is empty. Such a one is merely a conduit through which there is no longer any obstruction to the offering of God's grace or the flow of the creative energy, the flow of life. Indeed, beloved friends, many of you have journeyed with me for so long that you have taught yourself the only way to be in relationship with me is to be dependent upon me. You have journeyed with me for so long that you cannot imagine or would not let yourself imagine being my equal. And yet, in this book, every time it says, beloved and holy friends, indeed, beloved friends, it stopped a few times and said, please pay attention to what that means. To be a friend is to be an equal. Fully an equal. To be joined in friendship means to be in the recognition that there is no separation. The text goes on and says, you would not let yourself imagine letting go of me. Yet I say unto you, stepping into the fullness of capital L love requires letting go of everything you have possessed, even if that possession is me. For love requires finally step through the door into the kingdom and you declare, quote, I am that one sent of the Father, sent of the Creator, created before all things. I am only, capital L, love. I am only the energy of creation expressing in form. I am not my mind. I am not just the body. I am not just the personality. I am not just my history. I, my essence, my consciousness, do not belong to the world. I am that vibration, that note of capital L love, of the creative energy. I am the Christ, and as such, I do abide. I love equally. I love without reservation. I extend love without possessiveness. I extend love only to extend the presence of the Creator that another one might touch that place within them and be set free. Love as an energy cannot possess. Wherever there is a trace of conditionality, rest assured, the viciousness of fear is in the ascendancy. Therefore, If you cannot surrender your pet, if you cannot surrender the object that sits upon your counter in your kitchen, if you cannot surrender a beloved person into death, you cannot surrender a beloved who changes their mind and decides to move to Antarctica and do it with celebration, then rest assured there is yet a place within you that requires correction. Correction requires willingness and intention. And intention requires your desire that you dissolve even more deeply into the love which creation is, which is God, light, love, and creation itself. The next section is titled, Be the Presence of the Love that the Creator is. The text reads, Listen very carefully. Indeed, listen very, very carefully. If you would know the love of the Creator, you must be that love. You cannot know about it. You must literally be the presence of that love. Only then do you know the Creator, the creation, the flow of life, God, light, love itself. This then is the essence of the way of knowing. Knowing by being. Being that which you have knowledge or direct experience of, and by choosing to be only that. How is that done? It's done through the process of forgiveness. What's the process of forgiveness? To shebag, to cancel, to dismantle, to remove all of the false projections, all of the labels and identifications, all of the assumptions, all of the dogmas and teachings, all of the trivialities of the intellect, all of the thoughts about who you are as a person and how you should be in the world and how the world should be in response to you. Removing everything that doesn't belong leaves you as and with a direct experience of your true nature. As it says in the Course in Miracles at the very beginning, that nothing but the truth of love exists and nothing unreal exists. And what is true, what is real, cannot be hurt, cannot be attacked, cannot be damaged, chipped, dented, rusted, faded, or broken in any way. It's always been your true nature. It's always been available and accessible. Your job is not to find it. Your job is not to create it. Your job is not to build it from scratch. Your job is not to add to it. Your job is simply to remove every obstruction to your direct experience of it. The next line reads, Now, if you would truly know love, capital L love, look upon the things that you fear. Discover them, dig them up, and dig them out of yourself. Rest assured, any time that you must look at another and analyze them, there is something you fear. Anything that pushes your buttons is a sign that something is still requiring your love. From Lesson 3, a quote from the book in Lesson 3 on Forgiveness says, Reactivity indicates the need for self-forgiveness. In other words, dismantling a false perception. Anytime you have a strong negative reaction, it indicates your need to remove a false belief, a false perception, a false construct, an identification in your mind of you with something other than the flow of life. The text goes on and says, The way of knowing, beloved friends, can culminate only in the transformation of your mind to such a level of completion that you sit in your rocking chair and say, quote, there is only God. There has never been a separate me. There could never have been. There is only this moment in which love can dance, love can be celebrated and extended. Creator, what can we create this day that offers to the world the grace of the good, the holy, and the beautiful? Close quotes. The text goes on and says, I once described the highest state of consciousness, highest state of purification, as one in which the child was awakened, has awakened, and looks around him or her and sees to infinity. They see not where they begin and the Creator ends. For such is their union, such is their marriage, such is their dance, the unformed and the formed, the source and the created, the Creator and the creating, such is this alchemical marriage that one cannot look and see where the soul ends and the Creator begins. Yet the awakened mind knows that it is still the created, and it surrenders in perfect joy in each moment. Quote, Father, what would you have me do? What is your will for me? Close quotes. If you don't like Father, say Creator, say Mother, say Soul, say Spirit, say Light, say Love, say Creator. What would you have me do? What is the Creator's will for me? What is life's will for me? The text goes on and says, the awakened mind surrenders, not in subservience, but it surrenders because sanity has returned. It recognizes that it has never been the tiny gnat whining and complaining and trying to make life work the way it thinks it ought to. The truth of you has never been that part that thinks it knows better than the flow of life. The truth of you surrenders each moment. The truth of you dissolves in each moment. The truth of you abides in each moment. The truth of you knows that only the love of creation itself is real. And it says, Creator, what would you have me do? It opens itself and it receives the pebbles being dropped into its pond. Now, not by its own hand, but by the hand of grace, the perfect hand of mystery that I have called Abba, that love, that creative source, that power, that joy, that sublime, sweet, sweet mystery that is constantly creating. For love, for creation, must extend itself. No longer is there concern or worry over the body. No longer is there concern or worry over the state of the world. No longer is there concern or worry over anything. There is only the eternal dance of creation. The awakened mind knows that it is a participant in perfect mystery. There are no longer any blocks or fears whatsoever. And whenever you find yourself, wherever you find yourself, if you're asked to be crucified, dead and buried, so you can shock the world into realizing there's something else besides surviving, then you just do it. If it's given unto you to write books, you write them. So what? You're not attached. The flow of creativity is moving through you. If you are asked to take a simple picture that I placed in the mind of a certain artist and then distribute it to 15 million people, you simply do it because you're no longer attached to your ego. If love, capital L love, asks you through me or through another to move to the far ends of the earth to build a hut and to chant, you go and do it. What's the problem? There isn't any. You are as free as the wind. Only those born of the Spirit know the Spirit. The Spirit comes and goes where it does. You do not know where it came from. You do not know where it is going. You totally confuse the minds of humankind. You are free. For you listen to no other voice but the voice for love. What would you hold on to in a world of illusion? Learn to discover the content that pervades all form, and you will taste the perfect freedom, the alleviation of pain that comes with the attachment to form, even your own, even your very thoughts that yesterday you thought were true. Today, you have been taken even more deeply into love, capital L love, and what is in the past is allowed to pass away. Quote, yesterday I thought I knew God. Today I know God even more deeply because I've rescinded my need to be right about what I once thought I knew to be true. Father, God, light, love, creator, mother, give me even more of you. I want more. I desire more. You are infinite. You are my beloved. I want only to die in you ever more, ever deeper. Give me more of you, to taste you, to devour you, to die in you more and more. Close quotes. More and more becomes an eternal journey without end to a goal that has never changed. A journey with no distance, only the sublime experience of tasting the creation and then surrendering that taste in order to taste even more. Love comes to supplant fear, and learning to jump in order to receive the parachute becomes a delightful game to play. When I decided to allow the crucifixion, I jumped. Quote, can I find my Father even more deeply here? Close quotes. For me, it was the culmination of a life in which I developed trust that my Father would always catch me. That journey, by the way, has never ended. And those of you that would come to where I am, rest assured, you best not waste a single moment. For I am continually dying more and more into the creation. Beloved friends, we will end this lesson with this suggestion. Ask yourself, where is fear still abiding in my mind? Is there anything that I still fear? Is it the death of a husband or wife? Is it the growing up of a child? Is it the loss of a job? Is it being without shelter? Where is the edge of your fear? Can I imagine abiding without a man in my life? Can I abide without a woman in my life? Close quotes. This is nothing more than unhealed mother and father issues. It is an authority problem. The awakened abide only with the Creator, only in the flow of life. They cannot any longer comprehend possessing or being possessed. They allow all things and trust all things. They live without reservation, and they love without reservation. They love the one who stands before them as the embodiment of their very beloved, the content or the essence, which is the very presence of creation, of God, of light, of love. For when you look upon your brother or sister and see only Christ, you have seen with the eyes of Christ, and Christ simply loves. Love in this term means allows, accepts, surrenders, trusts, and therefore transcends. So this is the end of that segment. This is the end of that lesson. And it's critically important to come back and slow this down. Where is fear still abiding in my mind? How is this relevant? This is the Mind Shifters radio show. This was created by Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice. This is about a reality management worksheet. This is about the Mind Shifter tool, which is targeted journaling. This is about the codependence to interdependence tool, which is any advice I would give to somebody else is the perfect advice for me. This is about the circle of life and how to play it. This is about taking the high road versus the low road. This is about the responsibility communication tool. This is about learning a series of tools to apply in my life so that I move to be more and more 100% responsible in each moment for the experience of life I'm creating. How is that related to this work? Because this text reads, "Beloved friends, here is a suggestion. Ask yourself these questions. Where is fear still abiding in my mind? Is there anything that I still fear? Do I fear being without shelter? Do I fear growing up without a child? Do I fear losing a job? Do I fear losing a husband or wife? If I have any of those fears, and I become consciously aware of them, I can put them on a worksheet, figure out what thought I'm using to create that fear, figure out the goal that's contained in that thought that's not getting met, and then step through the worksheet process in which I cancel the thought and the goal. And when I repeat that I cancel the thought and the goal, and I repeat my willingness to give up my need to be right or my craving to be right, and I ask to be shown the hidden part of my mind, I begin to dismantle the mechanism within me that has me grasping for or identifying with something other than my true nature, other than my essence. And the more I do that, and this work calls that forgiveness, the more I apply the tool of forgiveness to remove whatever doesn't belong in my consciousness, as this book says, the deeper I take myself into the purity of my own consciousness. And over again, this book says, my consciousness is the energy of creation expressing in form, is connected to all minds and the one mind, is capital L love expressing in form. So what we are being called to do in lesson 26, asking, is there any fear still left in me? Dr. Michael Rice and Jeannie Rice on the whyagain.org website provide a whole series of tools to help me identify where I might have fears that I'm not consciously aware of. I can start with a mind shifter and give myself an hour or more to write and use the target of the mind shifter as part of this free association or journaling or core dumping or spelunking in the consciousness of my mind to discover where I might be holding on to thoughts or beliefs or fears or worries or sadnesses or guilts that drive my perception every time they get resonated, because the more of that I clear out of my consciousness, the easier it is for me to have a direct live experience of my true nature. And the more I do that, the better my life gets. The more I am able to be in alignment with the creative energy that wants to express uniquely through me in each moment. And the more I'm able to extend that energy, what this book calls the good, the holy, and the beautiful. This work, the Mind Shifter tool, the reality management worksheet, the codependence to interdependence worksheet, the mind goal management sheet, the communication, did you hear what I think I said, worksheet, all of these tools are designed to either do one of two things: help me stir up and become aware of the garbage that's in me, and or dismantle it and release any attachment I have to it. And in that process, I used to quite often refer to it a two-prong process. One of them is at deeper and deeper levels, tap into my true nature as love. And the other prong is every time I feel something less than love, apply a tool to dismantle it and remove it. And then go back to just being the extension of love and form, being aware of my true nature as the extension of love and form, being aware that everyone I interact with is the extension of love and form, and that this unfolding of life must, by necessity, always go in ways that I cannot predict, cannot possibly conform to my thoughts about what should be for more than a few moments here and there, because there is so much more going on in any given moment in my life and the world around me than I have any capacity for tracking, much less controlling, in my conscious mind. And there's ancient wisdom about this. It's not just the Way of Mastery. It's not just Dr. Michael Rice. It's not just Guy Finley. It's not just lines from the movie City of Angels, where the angel says to the surgeon, there's a lot more going on here than you know about, when the surgeon's upset because the patient died and she thinks she did everything right. That's the story of our lives. That's why this book uses a term like mystery. Being in relationship with the mystery, understanding that your actual presence here is a mystery, within a mystery, within a mystery. Learning to live in the questioning of that mystery, opening to it over and over again, as Rilke would call us to, without demanding an answer, without demanding a pat answer. So if you want a little bit more specifics on how can I figure out, is there still fear abiding in my mind and what might those fears be, I can use a tool like the Mind Shifter tool. And there are, you know, a growing number of Mind Shifter statements available in that Mind Shifter worksheet. Or you can call into the support group or call into the internet show and have a conversation with somebody, and in the interaction with you and somebody else, with careful listening to your words, you can craft your own mind shifter that will be specifically tuned into what it is your mind is hiding from you, and then give you an opportunity to step into revealing that more efficiently. So we're being called to being more aware of our true nature, to understand that the knowledge that this book talks about, true knowledge, is not about the processing of your mind or your intellect. It's about the direct lived experience without all of the thoughts, judgments, perceptions, dogmas, beliefs from the past. It's about being in direct connection with the extension of the flow of creative energy that we call life, and to notice the earliest warning signs as they arise that say, I'm in contraction, I'm in judgment, I'm in fear, I'm in anger, I'm in hurt, I'm in shame. And just recognizing that whatever I experience is being created where I'm experiencing it. It's being created inside me. And then if it's something I would prefer not to be experiencing as much of, once I recognize that it's being created inside me and that's known to me because I'm experiencing it inside of me, now I've got the awareness and then hopefully the tools to choose differently, to create differently, to create with the flow of life rather than fighting against it. And as that happens, life moves forward in a way that I start to prefer. Rather than me fighting against the flow of life, I'm co-creating with life experiences that I prefer to have. And as this book has told us in the fifth lesson with the keys to the kingdom, the more I choose to do that, the more I'm going to prefer the results I get, the more tempting it's going to be for me to think, oh, what a fine boy am I. Look what I've created. And when that tendency arises and strengthens, that's when it's critically important for me to remind myself, listen, Tim, sweetheart, you didn't create yourself. You don't even know when you were created. You're not doing this. This is being done through you. You're not living this life. Life is living through and as you. You're not solving all of these problems. Life is not a problem. Life is a flow. It is critically important for me to understand that the more I prefer life because I'm getting in the flow, I'm allowing it, I'm surrendering to be taught by it, I'm keeping my intention focused on that flow of energy, I'm letting that flow of energy bring these energies of desire up within me that might at different points in time crystallize into certain thoughts and plans. The more I let that happen, the better my life gets, the more I realize, oh, I think quite a fascinating, a wonderful creator. I've manifested this. I should go out and teach other people how to manifest. I should get them to give me lots of money. The more I think that, the more danger there is for me to try and take responsibility for or credit for what's happening and how much better my experience of life is. And that's when I need to remind myself, I'm being lived. It's not me doing all of this wonderful stuff. It's life itself extending, expressing through me that's creating. And if I decide to take credit for it, I'm just going to pour garbage into the stew. I'm not going to be able to make it better because there's no way my mind can even begin to comprehend how I got here. My mind can't even comprehend how I digest the food I had for breakfast, much less when I was created, how I was created, by who, and what process. And the more I settle into that and allow and ask to be taught by the flow of life itself, the more I can work with the flow of life, the more I can be a conduit for that flow of life, and the better everyone who comes into contact with me experiences their own life and experiences me. So, the Way of Mastery says, please look carefully within yourself for any of your fears, any of your identifications. Go and look around your home. This is not a call to say, sell everything you have and move out into the street as a beggar. This is simply a call to say, if you look around your house and your eyes fall on a possession that you have and the thought comes up in you, oh, I couldn't bear to get rid of this. I couldn't live without this. Work on dismantling your attachment to that thing, even if you don't give it away. This book says give it away. Well, you can accomplish the same thing by adjusting your mindset so that you wouldn't be creating the experience of being devastated if you walked home one day and the house had burned down or someone had broken in and stolen this precious thing. You don't have to give it away to change your identification with it. You don't have to actually be physically removed from it to understand it does not add any value to you. That the value of your life and your presence in life is whole and complete in your essence. And Michael Rice and Jeannie are providing a whole series of very specific tools to make it even easier for you to identify where you might have a fear, where you might have an attachment to something, where you might be holding a belief that says you can't survive or you can't be happy unless you have this or that person or this or that thing. And the more you identify those beliefs within you, those stuck points, those tensions, and apply the tools as they're offered at whyagain.com, org, the more you apply those tools, the more you experience the freedom of the awareness of your true nature. And your ability to extend that awareness and appreciation of that true nature of yourself and everyone and everything you interact with. So that's our offering for today. We've got about 15 or 17 minutes left before the second portion of our Mind Shifters Radio today. And we have plenty of time for comments or questions. Or answers or testimonials, 563-999-3581. Call that number, press 1, and we can have a conversation. Again, the core of this work is for me to understand how I'm creating my experience of life. I had another session with a gentleman in his mid-70s today. And he's just learning about this. And he had a situation where his son moved out. And he came in today and said, this just makes me very sad. And so we started talking about how the core of this work is to understand the outside event is not making him have any emotion, sadness or anything else. And as you might imagine, it was quite a challenge for this person who's in his mid-70s to entertain the idea that nothing about his son moving out is causing an emotion in him. And he was quite upset with that concept until we started to describe it, give him ways that he can start observing it for himself, and by the end of the session, he was much more lighthearted and chuckling about it and understanding that it's okay if he wants to be sad. It's okay if he wants to look at the situation with his son and generate joy as though this is his son moving on to the next level of his life and growing and his independence, and that it might even be seen as an indication of success for him as a father and for his son as a person. And yet, it's very real that life does go on. And I do generate my responses by the way I choose to interpret, or I generate my emotions by the way I choose to interpret and respond to those life situations. Area code 314, you're in the air.
Hello, Dr. Tim. It's Doug. Good morning.
Welcome. How are you?
I felt like I don't know exactly what I'm hoping for in making the call, other than that, you know, I feel like there's just so, I so enjoy this, and it's so helpful, and at the same time, so challenging to my mind. And I feel like today's talk in particular reading is the idea that I need to surrender everything and be love, and at the same time, then I get some guidance or something to know what to do. What is there for me to do now? And now, and my, I'm not even expressing this very well, but I feel like I feel like the answer is always whatever you want to do. It's like, I don't feel like, I never feel like God says do this or do that or do the other thing. It's like whatever you want to do is okay. But going after what I want seems like not what's being suggested, you know, I guess. And the other thing that I will say is that I'm immensely aware of, you know, I don't have to go looking for where am I afraid. It's like when I wake up, I breathe just to stay calm enough. You know, it's like fear is everywhere. It's about everything. It's just ridiculous. And one time you told me a very long time ago, I'm one of the most fearful people, you know, and at the time it was hard for me to believe, but right now it isn't because I just see it. So I guess my purpose here is just to see what evolves out of saying these things and calling in and talking, because I find great comfort in the reading, and I want to move towards that space. And at the same time, I feel, I guess my mind is trying to figure it out or something. Oh, I'm...
Yeah, well, that's for most of us, right? That's what Michael Rice says. That's the number one pseudo-solution of the non-being mind. We've been trained in this culture to look for the pat answers and to think that there is a pat answer and we need to get it right or we're going to get punished or we're going to miss out on the reward. And so we lean into, especially those of us who have been gifted with a significant intellectual intelligence, it gets even, you know, more strongly habituated for those of us who have found good success from that in the past.
I see. Mm-hmm.
Right, so we try to figure it out. But the essence of this work is that there is no figuring it out. Right, that's evidence that the ego is kicking in, trying to claim ownership or control or wisdom. And the truth of the life that we're given is that this thing we call our intellect is so underpowered to be able to comprehend life that it isn't even funny. It's just, that's why these teachings keep saying your intellect, your ego, is just a very simple tool, right? You wouldn't buy all of the material for a house, including the electrical wiring and the plumbing, all of the mortar, all of the bricks, all of the wood, all the flooring. You wouldn't buy all of that, put it in a heap, and throw a hammer on top of it and say, build me a house. The tool, the hammer, isn't capable of building the house all by itself. And yet, try to build a house without a hammer, you're going to have a lot more hard work ahead of you. The hammer is a very useful tool. But it's just that. And what these teachings are trying to get us to comprehend is that my conscious logical mind is to my life as the hammer is to the building of a house. Just a very simple tool. And the way for me to unlock exponentially more powerful, integrated wisdom, knowing, etc., is to ask to be taught, to surrender, to allow, to intend to be aligned with the flow of creation. What I can comprehend, what can be shown to me, if I don't insist that my intellect figure it out, goes beyond what words can share each new heartbeat. And you could say that's the core of this work right there. Because for most of us who've been trained to so heavily rely on the intellect, that's the brick wall that we're facing. It's like the story, when I said brick wall, it reminds me of the story that Guy Finley tells of the roving reporter, and he goes out, and all of a sudden he sees a road that's not on his map or his GPS, and he gets curious, so he takes this road. Next thing you know, he's driving out in the country and there's nothing around. Then he seems to see in the distance a town. And as he gets closer to the town, he sees off on his left and his right that there are people who are sitting, standing, lying down, crying next to or beating their heads against these brick walls. And so he's an investigative reporter. He's got to go check this out. So he gets out of his car and he goes and he says, you know, he tries to walk over to somebody who's there banging their head against the wall, wants to ask him, why don't you just walk around this thing? And he can't even get to that person, and a brick wall pops up in front of him. And he goes to walk around it, and the brick wall moves. And he goes to walk around to the right, and the brick wall moves. He tries to climb over it. It gets taller. He jumps down. Well, he's a very enlightened guy, so he knows better than to beat his head against the brick wall. So he sits down and meditates, and when he opens his eyes, the wall's gone. So he thinks, oh, good, I'll go back to my car and I'll get out of here. He starts back towards the car. A wall pops up. So he sits down again and starts observing. And then off to his right, he sees an older gentleman, so old that he thinks, oh, my God, this person's going to die before they get around that wall. And the wall pops up in front of the person. As the reporter is watching, the older gentleman mouths some words and then walks right through the wall like it wasn't there, just like it was a puff of smoke. And the reporter jumps up and starts screaming, tries to run after him, and of course a wall pops up, gets up on top of the wall and shouts over. Eventually the old gentleman comes back to him and says, what's the matter, buddy? And the reporter says, I can't believe this. I just saw magic. Are you a wizard? What just happened? He said, no such thing. And the reporter says, oh, come on. We're all stuck here. These walls are popping up. No one can move. And you just say something and walk right through it like it wasn't there. What did you say? I've got to know these magic words. And the old man said, it's nothing, really. I just said these 11 words I learned a long time ago whenever I get stuck. Who I have been is powerless to take me any further. Who I have been, what I think of myself, who I am as an ego, what is my history? The great and powerful Dr. Hayes, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. I'm the psychologist. I've read The Way of Mastery more than anybody I know. I am so high and mighty. I've done more worksheets. I can spout Guy Finley stories. That is powerless to take me any further whenever I get stuck in my life, whenever a wall pops up. Whenever I wake up and feel a fear. And by waking up, I mean wake up in the morning or come to a realization in the middle of the day. In that moment, if I don't surrender to the flow of life, if I don't ask to be taught, if I don't look inside myself for what's creating the tension or the resistance or the fear, I will not move past that wall. I will stay who I have been. And unless I've reached this state of bliss and full enlightenment and I have no desires of any kind, I don't really want to stay where I am or what I've been. I don't want to fight for my right to be right when I'm in pain. And that's what all of us have been trained to do.
Indeed. Okay. Yeah. It just, my mind, of course, wants to say, well, then how can I possibly move any further if everything I've been and become doesn't help me to move farther? That's what it wants to do, of course.
And that is, I have to give that up. Right? I have to give that up and let myself become something other than everything I have thought I've been. Because these teachings say over and over again, I am not my thoughts about myself. I am not my beliefs. I am not just the body. It goes on and on and on.
Yeah. Well, at least I can sense that there's something in that that will help me. You know, it's like I can sense that. I can't figure it out.
Really? Like, you can't figure it out?
No. I can't. Yeah. It's almost like talking to the great wizard, and every time you ask a question, I mean, I know I'm not, this is just for fun, but it's sort of in the mind. Every time you ask for a solution, you get another mystery, you know, that you can only let go into.
Right, but listen, that's the point of this. You know, you ask for the meaning of life and you're told it's a mystery. That's the point of this work. It's a mystery within a mystery within a mystery. You are a mystery within a mystery within a mystery.
You are
part of the unlimited consciousness, which is always extending and growing. Life isn't done living itself yet. Creation isn't done creating yet. So how can you know the answers when you are a part of that? You can't. So that's exactly right. If you go to the wizard on the mountaintop, if it's an actual wizard, you're going to come down with more questions than you had when you went up.
Yep.
Because that's the nature of growth and learning, is to be able to ask in each moment, what more is there to life? What more can I? And, you know, this reading says, you know, Yeshua is saying in this work, it's never ended. I said to the Creator, I said to God, I said to Light, to Love, to Abba, I want more of you. I want to learn. I want to drink of you. I want to taste of you more and more. He says, it's never ended. I didn't get it. It's not like these religions that say, you know, Christ is the God, as any more than you are part of the flow of life that people call God. There's not this arriving. There's not this final destination point. There is mystery extending. Say that again.
I said that feels helpful. Knowing there is no end point, there's no there that I'm trying to get to or expect that I'm at.
All right. Well, I thank you for the question and the comment. We're out of time, so I will mute you so you can listen to the second hour if that's your choice. Blessings. I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff that we call love. We actually are love. The energy of creation expressing in form, and everything else is false. And I will start the audio for the second hour, which is titled Communication Part 1.
We'll investigate the fact that there are two types of communication. Generally speaking, in the world, what we're taught to do is a thing that I like to call projection communication. And that is, we take the output of our minds, what's going on between our ears, and we talk as though what's going on between our ears is actually what's happening out there, as opposed to using language that recognizes that what's going on between our ears is unique to us. It belongs to us. It belongs to no one else. And to just give an illustration of that, I'm going to do a piece of art. We've actually done this in a couple of other workshops, but this illustrates the point for us, and that is if I draw a drawing here, many people look at that drawing and recognize it. And what they'll recognize it as is anything from a Volkswagen to somebody peeking over a table to Kilroy. Oftentimes we'll get people who will look at that and say, oh, well, that's a two-door igloo. And my offering is that what that is that's lines on a board and that's all. The meaning of a two-door igloo or a Volkswagen or someone peeking over a table or Kilroy comes from the content of the observing mind. So when this person looks at these lines on the board, depending on the content of their mind, that framework will resonate or cause brain cells to fire. And when brain cells fire, information that is internal to us fills in and gives meaning to this framework. Now, if we took someone from the jungles of Guatemala, this person has never seen anything more complex than a dugout canoe, and we showed them these lines on the board, how long do you suppose it would take for them to figure out that that's a two-door igloo? What teaching would you have to do? What experiences would you have to give this person from the jungles of Guatemala to get them to even conceive of this possibly meaning a two-door igloo? We have somebody who lives in a jungle setting in a subtropical region of the world. They've probably never seen temperatures go below 70 degrees. They've never read a book. They've never seen a television. What is this thing that comes from the sky you tell us about that comes down in white flakes? And when it lands on my hand, it is what I know as water. What are you talking about? I mean, how are you going to explain that to the person from the jungles of South America as you attempt to explain a two-door igloo? And then how are you going to explain to this man that there's actually a place in the world where a wave jumps up out of the ocean and it is so cold that that wave actually freezes in midair, solid, takes what he knows is a liquid water and turns it into something solid. And that something solid, you're going to find a way to saw this water, to cut this water into blocks and build a structure that people can live in. Water turned solid, and you live in it. How is this guy ever going to make any sense of that? Well, what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to give him information. You're going to have to help him to build brain cells. And when I talk about building brain cells, I'm not talking about building new physical structure. I'm talking about putting information into that structure. When you look at that and go two-door igloo, you have that information already in your mind. You have all the files that it takes, and they'd be pretty significant when you really recognize how many files have to fire simultaneously to give you the idea of a two-door igloo, and how much work you're going to have to do for this fellow to have the brain cells that can even start to conceive of a two-door igloo. So in order for him to hold that meaning, he's got to have that content. When we look at communication, in order for any mind to hold a meaning, that mind has to have that content. And once a mind has that content, if that mind utilizes projection communication, i.e., if I said that is a two-door igloo, there's nothing there about an igloo. The words I'm using describe an interior reality that I hold as a possibility for that framework. Now, let's imagine for a minute that our two-door igloo is a very sensitive being, very sensitive person. And I hold, let's say, for instance, maybe I was an Eskimo and life in the igloo was very painful for me. And so I start to describe all of the experiences that an igloo means to me, all of the content that I have, but I use words that make everyone around me think that everything I'm experiencing inside of me is all the fault of the igloo. And this sensitive igloo goes, "What, you're blaming me for all of that pain? But I had nothing to do with it." When we utilize projection communication, we use words that attempt to say that the content of our mind must be about someone else. And once you recognize how this mind works and the role that words play in it, what you'll recognize is that the words that you use to describe the content of your mind are describing the content of your mind. The minute you insist that those words must be true about someone else, and that someone else doesn't hold that as true about them, you're going to end up with a conflict. And chances are you'll put an end to communication in that situation. Our objective with this workshop is to assist people to be able to open their communication. When I can use what we'll describe tonight as responsibility communication, I'm going to use words that represent to whoever I'm speaking the reality that I understand that I am describing the content of my own mind, and that my communication is about taking the content of my mind and intact getting that meaning into your mind. We're going to describe that as communication. That's going to be our definition. And when you decide that you really want to communicate, I would offer that needs to be your primary goal. I hold a reality that belongs to me. I am attempting to get the reality that belongs to me intact into your mind. If I can do that, I have communicated successfully. If I use words that tell you that the content of my mind is accurate about you, then I'm not likely to be able to communicate. I'm not likely to be able to get the content of my mind accurately into your mind because I'm going to run into some interference. We're going to offer a definition tonight of a word. And the definition we're going to offer is that a word is a tool of communication. Does that sound like a reasonable definition to everyone here tonight? That a word is a tool of communication? Hello? Yeah, I need to hear you. And when we use words, is it reasonable to assume those words are indicative of an interaction between two or more people? In this case, I'm one and you as a group are the other. So my using words is an indication of an interaction between us. Reasonable? Okay. So now, what I'm going to ask you to do is to notice that right now in your head, there are words running. And you're not communicating those words with anyone. If words are tools of communication indicative of an interaction between two, who's in there with you? Who's talking to who? What is it that gives meaning to everything that your mind sees? And particularly if you're in some sort of emotional upset, also informs you that your upset is the responsibility of the person you're attempting to communicate with. And I would offer that your reality, that is the output of your mind, is your responsibility and your responsibility only. If you attempt to communicate to me in a way that indicates your reality must be true about me, let's say I've done a particular behavior, and you insist that that behavior means something, your insistence that that behavior means something really means that if you did the behavior I did, that that's what it would mean. But if you insist that when you describe your reality, that that meaning must be true about me, and I don't happen to hold that as true, and I don't happen to like that, then chances are we're going to put an end to communication. So communication isn't about insisting that someone else agree with your reality. That's a whole different process than communication. Communication is about getting the reality you have intact into the mind of the person that you're speaking to. And there's kind of an interesting thing to do with translations. There's a website you can go in and you can put a phrase into this website, and it will translate it into different languages for you. And oftentimes, you know, you hear people who speak different languages, and let's say you're talking with someone who speaks Italian, and there's someone else who speaks Italian with them, and they're trying to communicate something with you, and they turn to their friend who's also Italian and says, well, how do you say that in English? And their friend says, you can't say that in English. There's certain ideas that just aren't translatable because words describe content of mind, and content of mind is unique and individual and cultural. Certain cultures don't have the same experiences that others have. And so their ideas are not translatable. So the name of my main workshop is Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And so we put Why Is This Happening to Me Again into a translation program that comes up with translations from several different languages. So here's Why Is This Happening to Me Again when it translates into French. Why this occur is with me still. And then if we take that and translate it back into English, and then we put that translation into German, then what it will come out in German is, why step this still is with me up? And then if we put that into Italian, what comes back from an Italian translation is, why ago a step this anchor is with me in on? You can see things are getting a little more complicated. Let's take that and put it into a translator and put it back into English. And in English, what it comes back as, why has a stage this shoring is with me inside on? Interesting little change from why is this happening to me again. But it's kind of an indicator of what happens when you go through the brain cells of different people. We've all, you know, played that parlor game where we whisper a phrase to someone and it goes around the room and see if you recognize it when it comes out of the other side of the room, and often it's not recognizable. And the reason is not because people don't remember the phrase. The reason is because the phrase is a string of words that resonates content. And that content that fires then is communicated with a string of words that accurately represent for the person who was listening the first time around. It brings words forward that describe the content that came forward. And so
the ideas have changed. By the time you get that through 20 different minds, 20 different translations, because the truth is, none of us speak the same language. Oh, we call it English. Winston Churchill said we have the privilege of being separated by a common language. Because when I speak a word, I naturally expect that the word means the same for you as it does for me. And when you understand how the human mind works, that's simply not the truth. It just doesn't work that way. In fact, words are so powerful at directing human perception that if you go back 2,000 years ago in the Aramaic language, we hear a phrase when it's translated through the Greek that goes something like this. The eye is the lamp of the soul. If the light for you is darkness, how deep will your darkness become? Have you ever read that phrase out of the Greek scriptures and gone, huh? What does that mean? If we go to the Aramaic, here's what that phrase says. There's some interesting Harvard research that was done that says that in a time frame where 10,000 brain cells fire, that is, there are 10,000 measurable units of electrical activity, that the max amount of information that shows up in the conscious mind is 9 bits of data. It's estimated in that same time frame that there are approximately 20 trillion bits of data potentially available. So our mind uses a tiny fragment of what's going on in the world and takes a tiny fragment of what goes on in the mind to build its reality. And what was said in the Aramaic 2,000 years ago was the perceptual output of your mind, your reality, is the light or the guide for your journey through the 20 trillion bit world. It is the light for your earthly life. In Aramaic, darkness was hostility or fear. And so that next sentence says, if the light, that is the thing that guides you, is darkness. In one of our earlier workshops, we made a couple of inquiries of people. We asked folks how many had ever held a newborn child. And we asked each person who had held a newborn child to give us a descriptor that described the essence of that newborn. And we put a list on the board, and the list that we came up with was that the newborn was awesome, was love, was purity, peace, sweetness, inner sense, joy, wonder, and angelic. And we noticed that every word that described the newborn was some variation on the theme of love. And we offered the thought that love, the words that describe the newborn, are the words that describe our essential nature. And that our essential nature, our being, is love. That in Aramaic is light. If the light for you is darkness, and then we ask people, how many have ever done something you regret? Anybody ever do something you regret? And then think back to a time when you did something you regretted and look at what you were feeling as you did that. And we created another list. It's interesting to note, never in all the thousands of people that I've asked these two questions of, has anything from this side of the list ever turned up over here when we asked people when they did something they regretted. Regret always involves some form of hostility and fear. In Aramaic, that's darkness. And so what Yeshua was saying 2,000 years ago is there is a way to keep your intelligence turned on, and there is a definable way to turn it off. If hostility or fear, if that for you is the light, then how deep will your darkness become? What kind of things will you do to destroy yourself if the activity of hostility or fear is in your mind when you do a behavior? So this perceptual mind, and I like to use an example of, you know, how many here have ever been to Mammoth Cave? Anybody ever been to Mammoth Cave? It is absolutely mammoth. I mean, it's unbelievable the size of this cave. Imagine that we put you in Mammoth Cave and we give you a pen light. Now, in Mammoth Cave with a pen light, you can see one little, tiny fragment of the cave at a time. I mean, it's just so huge, it's unfathomable. And that pen light can only show you the tiniest bit of it at a time. That's kind of like the human 9-bit mind looking in a 20 trillion bit world. Now let's imagine that we told you that we have a clear plastic bag and we put $1 million worth of diamonds in the bag somewhere out in plain sight on the wall of the cave, and if you can get the diamonds and get out of the cave alive, they're yours. What would be the most important skill you could have? Wouldn't it be the ability to point the light in the right place at the right time for what you need to do next in the cave to get to the diamonds and get out with them? Let's imagine that you use the light and you look and you look and you carefully search the wall of the cave, and finally you see that glitter of the diamonds and you go, I've got them. There they are. And in order not to lose them, of course, you keep the light shining on the diamonds and you go charging off toward the diamonds. And you don't use the light to show you the 30-foot pit in front of you. You've got a serious problem, right? Well, that's exactly the same if you allow either hostility or fear to enter into your mind. If so, your lights are out. And if that becomes your guidance, then you'll do things you regret. And that's that phrase, how deep will that darkness become? If you want to do real communication in your relationships, in your life, the first thing you need to do is maintain intelligence. The first step to maintaining intelligence is to keep the lights on. You've got to keep love active in your mind. And many people have thought of it as a religious principle when they said to Yeshua 2,000 years ago, what's most important in the law? And it's made to sound like some kind of something that belongs to some old fogies in the desert and, you know, thousands of years ago, and it really doesn't have much to do with us modern, updated people today. But he said the first law was, when you think of an object of attention like the Creator, your neighbor, or yourself, you got to keep your lights on. You've got to stay connected to love. Because if you don't, then darkness is your guide. How deep will your darkness become if hostility or fear is your guide? So that becomes the first rule to communication. You want to make sure that you stay connected and you keep your lights on. You keep love active in your mind. And Yeshua goes on to tell us about the power of words. In fact, he says that every idle word will be accounted for. Now, one of the things we do a lot in this work, there's a course we do called Laws of Living, and in Laws of Living, we get into a thing we call regulatory speech. And regulatory speech is that the words that the mind uses to regulate our physiology, to regulate our creative process, and to regulate what we see in our world. And so that's called regulatory speech. And the words that people use create such an impact in their physiology, and most people don't recognize that their words have that kind of power. Yeshua gave it so much emphasis that he said, every idle word will be accounted for. Now, when we interact with people in Laws of Living, we actually play a game we call the Regulatory Peach Game. It's kind of interesting how it got the name Regulatory Peaches. During a Laws of Living course at Heartland, our teaching center, we were doing this course, and there was a woman that was there with her 3-year-old son. Little guy's name was Orion. And Orion was sound asleep on his blanket beside Mom, and for a good part of the day, we've been talking about regulatory speech, and Ryan's up, and he's coloring, and he's listening, and he goes to sleep, and finally, he's just waking up out of a sleep as we're getting ready to take an intermission. And someone has gone back into the kitchen and brought out a huge bowl of peaches for a snack. And Orion, kind of rubbing his eyes, wakes up and looks over at these peaches coming out and being placed on the food bar, which is in our classroom. And he says, just loud enough, of course, for everybody in the room to hear, Mom, are those regulatory peaches? course, we've been talking about regulatory speech all day. And so we call it the regulatory peach game. And what we do is we invite people to point out to each other the kinds of words that they use and the kinds of power phrases that they use. When people first start to play that game, they oftentimes become very upset because every other word out of their mouths relates to some form of hostility or fear. And oftentimes we'll see people when we, you know, we ask everybody's permission, are you willing to play this game? And, oh, yeah, it sounds great, sure, point my words out to me. But there comes a point where people are like, well, why don't you just let me talk? I can't say anything. You just keep, it's like, no, all we're doing is pointing out your words. And when people use words, they have no idea what kind of power those words have oftentimes. I remember working with a young man from one of the northern states. He had moved to Atlanta. He'd had a lot of challenges with his parents, and like he was out of there. He was not having anything to do with them. And one day his parents called and said they were on their way to Florida. They were coming through Atlanta and wanted to visit with him, spend some time with him. The first words out of his mouth were, my parents are a pain in the you-know-what. The day his parents arrived, he got hemorrhoids. The day his parents left, his hemorrhoids left. That's the power of our words. Watch how you communicate with yourself and that your communications toward yourself come through a mind with the lights on, where love is present. Because when you utilize hostile and fearful power phrases toward yourself, you can be creating things in your life that you really don't want to create. You can be creating things in your life you really don't want to create. And once you recognize that, then you start looking at those power phrases. Because what we know is we live in a world of energy, we don't live in a world of matter. And in this world of energy, the energies that we engage in determine how our world unfolds around us. For instance, if you watch people whose power phrases are things like, I can't stand that, what you'll find is people who end up with foot and leg problems. I can't stomach that. You'll see people oftentimes who have digestive problems. That's a pain in the neck or any other body part. And they end up with problems in that part of their structure because as an energetic system, the structure is always listening and giving a quality to the frequencies we engage in with our thoughts and with our words. There's a cell biologist named Bruce Lipton. We have a DVD called Mind-Body Bioenergetics. And that DVD is a one-hour television interview with myself and a one-hour television interview with this fellow named Bruce Lipton. He's a cell biologist, and what Bruce is showing is that when you think a thought, and of course that's represented by a word, when you think a thought, that thought literally turns into a molecule in your structure. It solidifies as an energetic device we call a molecule or a neuropeptide. That neuropeptide circulates around in your structure until it finds a cell that has a receptor site that matches. It locks onto that receptor site, and then the cell replicates the thought chemically. The neuropeptide is replicated. And you get to live with the chemistry of your thoughts. There's an interesting video on YouTube. I just got an email about it, and I'm not sure where to find it, except that the first letters on it are EFT if you want to look it up. It just was put on there in the last day or two. And what it shows is live blood analysis. When someone is in a normal, healthy, happy state and how the blood cells move and how they look. And then in this experiment, what they did is they had the experimenter and someone who had no idea what was going on, they showed the blood of both of those people, the live blood of both of those people. And then they sent the fellow who is the participant out of the room and the experimenter sends hate to this fellow. And then they bring him back in the room immediately, and they do more live blood analysis on both of those people. The blood of the person sending the hate was a disastrous mess. when you look at the way blood is supposed to look under live cell analysis, it was just, I mean, it was so graphic, you could see the difference in it, by the person sending the hate. To hate another is like taking a poison and hoping someone else will die. And then, looking at the blood of the person it was sent to, his blood had also deteriorated. Not, I don't think, because that person was sent hate, but because we are resonant beings, if we have hate in us, then the energy of someone else's hate has a place to land. There's resonance there, and landing in us, it can produce a result in us. And so our words become a real energetic key to how vital and alive our energy system is. And we want to look at that and be responsible for that. One person said that tears are words that the heart cannot express. I would offer that a lack of communication is the cause of death. Well, Michael, come on, now isn't that a little extreme? Not when you recognize that we're energetic beings, and when there's something we don't want to communicate about, it's something we have a thought about that is of hostility or fear. It's something, generally speaking, that we don't want to deal with, that we don't want to hide, that we don't want to communicate about. And it creates such pain, and the insight the person had who said, tears are the words the heart can't express, is this body-mind unit trying to warn us that there's something we need to be dealing with. And when we refuse to communicate and deal with something, we lock that energy inside of us, and it produces disastrous results. When we can open and communicate, then we can bring that energy out and expose it to the light. And being exposed to the light, we create a change in that energy. And that change leads to higher levels of health, because when we hold this being that we are as love, active and present in our own thoughts, in our own words, in our own feelings, if there's anything of a destructive nature there that doesn't belong there, what happens is that, pardon me, what happens when we hold that destructive energy in the presence of love is that destructive energy starts to deteriorate. It starts to come undone. And so the idea of being able to communicate in the presence of love allows us to open the space in ourselves to bring everything forward, every neuropeptide forward that never belonged in human physiology in the first place. And by exposure to love, it starts to dissolve. It starts to disintegrate. It starts to come undone. And so we want to really be responsible for the quality of power phrases that we use and create a safe space in our lives where we can communicate about absolutely everything that we hold to be true in our lives. When we do that, we can start to bring change to the parts of us that we would rather function differently. And we will create much different results in our lives. You know, 2,000 years ago, they were talking about this topic with Yeshua, and they asked him, well, how do you tell where somebody's really at? And when you go to the Aramaic in the teachings of Yeshua, what you find is some of the most genius teachings possible on how to live a human life to the fullest. And so much of it gets lost in translation through languages and through minds that are filled with hostility and fear that it's almost not recognizable for what it is. But when they asked him, how do you tell where somebody's at? He said, you look at their fruit. You look at the results they produce. Your results are always a direct correlation to what you hold in you and to the words that you speak. And your words themselves are part of your fruit. When you start observing your own regulatory speech, if you find it taking you to a place you'd rather not go, that's when you want to be very aware and start to change that speech. Because when you can change that speech, you can change where your mind is taking you. You can start to function in a totally and completely different way and produce different results. Let me share an example of responsibility communication with you. The difference between projection communication, using words to describe the content of my mind as though it's outside of me, and responsibility communication. And this is a letter written by a woman who came to one of our intensives at Heartland a few years back, and I have her permission to share it. It's not, let anything out of the bag. And she was dealing with issues of a lack of money, finances, were her challenge. She was a dental consultant, and there was a man who was a world-renowned consultant, kind of in a similar field to hers, who was doing a seminar up in her region of the country. And she registered for and paid a pretty good dollar to go to this seminar. And here's her letter to the person who ran the seminar. Dear Dr. such and such, since our brief encounter at the Marriott Hotel in Cambridge last Friday, I've found I have an issue in me that I'd like your assistance in dealing with. On that day, you walked over to me, asked me what I did, told me I wasn't welcome, and asked me to leave. I felt a lot of resentment, indignation, and invalidation. I felt I was not heard, and I was placed in a no-choice situation. I thought, this man thinks I've misrepresented myself so that I can come and pirate his material. What I wanted then and now is to get rid of my resentment and feelings of invalidation and be able to communicate clearly, honestly, and openly with you, and I'd like your support in doing this. What I'd like to share with you is, even as all of this was going on Friday, there was a part of me saying, there's more here than meets the eye. Stay conscious and learn the lesson. I know my reality is this. I've shifted almost 180 degrees in my approach. And after what happened Friday, I realized I still hadn't come quite far enough. Thanks to you, that's totally clear to me now. It turns out you served as a catalyst for me to make some changes in how I serve my clients. I've enclosed some tapes from Dr. Michael Rice that I thought you might enjoy. I honestly think what he has to say has the potential to heal the planet. His series is entitled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And it's about forgiveness. I hope you listen and feed back to me what you think. I have several clients working with his tools, and we're finding them very powerful. Again, I'd like to acknowledge you for being my teacher and helping me surface an issue and heal it. I look forward to hearing from you and or perhaps meeting once again under more favorable circumstances. Peace and blessings. Joy. So she's paid big dollars and gets kicked out without a refund from this seminar. She writes this letter. A couple of days later, she hears from this fellow who has an office in Utah. He calls her and says, this is the most powerful piece of business communication I've seen in all my years in business. And I would like to meet with you and discuss it further. He was doing a seminar sometime in the next couple of weeks in New York, and where this particular weekend, he kicks her out of his seminar, though he's being paid to have her there. He, on his own nickel, flies in to see her. They meet. He invites her to come out and consult with him with his staff on communication. And this letter just follows step by step our responsibility communication process. He ends up offering her a job. And the job that he offers her is going to pay her more money than she's ever thought about making. And her money problem is solved. Although she decides it's not appropriate for her to take that job, turns it down. And a couple of months later, there was another person who was doing a similar consulting seminar. She went to it, paid the registration fee. And the first night of the workshop, the fellow who's up on stage doing the seminar points to her, asks who she is, and says, I want to meet with you. They meet, and it turns out, in the same circumstances where just a few weeks before she's getting kicked out, this fellow on Sunday afternoon with a whole room full of paying clients who are all in the dental profession turns his seminar over to her and asks her to come up and speak, and her money problem is solved. responsibility communication opens up the places in us that we don't want to open up to. And after we take an intermission, we'll come back and look at just how to do that process. Let's take a short intermission. So when we look at the impact that our words have on our minds and the light or the guide for our lives, it is profound. Because the mind, when you're looking at 9 bits of information out of 20 trillion, a potential of 20 trillion, the mind is showing evidence. And the only evidence your mind is allowed to show you is evidence that you give it permission to through your words. So let's use an example. If I live in a world of I'm right, you're wrong, it's settled, why argue? Anybody ever find themselves living in that world? Now, what you just did is you said to your evidential mind, mind, if I run into a situation where there's a situation where there's a conflict, mind, if I run into a situation where there's a conflict, you are only allowed to show me realities that prove that the conflict is somebody else's fault and that I'm right. So in essence, what I'm saying to my mind is, mind, when you build a reality about me, you go to the file where there's information about being right, and you select whatever information you need. It doesn't matter if it's a total lie. You select whatever information you need to prove that I'm right. And that's the only reality my mind will be able to generate about me. And then, if I'm thinking about someone else, I'm saying to my mind, mind, you go to my file on they're wrong. And you're only allowed to use that data to build a reality about them. And now, I live in a world of a fantasy. This is what has anybody here ever been accused of doing something that you absolutely never did? Of saying something that you never said?
Yes.
A few of you have. Has that happened to you once? How about putting your hand up if you've ever been accused? I see everybody in the room has their hand up. Okay, just now I'm going to count down. Keep your hands up if you want. I'm going to count down, and when we get to your number, I'm going to ask you to drop your hand. It's happened to you once, twice, three, four, infinite number of times. For most, it's infinite. Now, are all the people who've said you did something you absolutely didn't do, said something you absolutely didn't say, are they all liars? No, they're not liars. They actually saw you do it. They actually heard the words come out of your mouth, although it never happened. Because if they have a mindset of, I'm right and you're wrong, and there's a conflict where they've made a mistake, their mind can't show them that they've made a mistake. And if what they need is to hear the words come out of your mouth that prove that you're wrong, those brain cells will fire in them, and they'll actually hear you and see you. They'll hear you say the words. They'll see you do the behavior, even though it never happened. That's the nature of the evidential mind. In order to get past that, you have to love truth more than you love your own opinion. You have to love truth more than you love being right. You know, we live in a culture where, you know, they tell us that if you're just right, it will deliver so many wonderful things to you. Has anybody here who's gotten really good at proving that you're right noticed that proving that you're right gets you more and more and more alone all the time? It never delivers its promises. All that being right does is it locks your mind into the lie that you always have to be right, even when you're in error. And that isn't a way to create warm, wonderful relationships. And most people, through their communication, would like to create warm, wonderful relationships. And so we need to be willing to have a mind that is accurate in what it shows us. And so responsibility communication is about using language and is a system of tools for getting your mind to show you the most accurate data that it has about an object of attention or a situation, and then using words that describe the content of your mind in terms that everybody knows that you know that the content of your mind is about you, that it's not about them. And so That's what we want to look at. One of the things we know about the mind is that it is goal-driven. When you put a goal into the mind produces realities according to that goal. Because what happens when you put a goal into your mind is that you create a stress. And the functioning purpose of your mind is to alleviate that stress. And most people hold as a goal for their communication things like being right, winning, overpowering. And they think that that's what communication is for. And that's not what communication is for. Communication is for exchanging information with others. And when we can do that accurately, then our relationships with others will tend to blossom. When we do it inaccurately, when we do it for other purposes, our relationships will tend to fall apart and fold. And so the first step in responsibility communication is to make a commitment. And that is that I commit. Responsibility communication starts when I first of all commit to keeping the light on, to keeping love present in my mind, and communicating with you. Now, when I set that as a goal, and that goal is more powerful than all the other goals that I've ever held for my communication, then what I will do is I will set a stress into my mind, and my mind will do its best to give me information about what kind of behaviors I need to do to alleviate that stress. Along with keeping love present, it's a good idea to keep the idea of goodwill in that commitment. That goodwill will serve in bringing about true communication in my relationships. So I want to communicate with you about this situation. If you look at that letter that I wrote, that I read earlier, the letter I read earlier from Joy, she says, I have an issue that I'd like your assistance in dealing with. Now, many people in a situation like she was in would be enraged. She was able to own her feelings of upset, but to remember that the goal of her communication was to enlist support in her healing process rather than being abusive toward the person that she felt had been abusive to her. When you set those kinds of goals, and those goals are set with words, then your mind goes to work producing data that shows you how to do behaviors that will carry out those goals. And then you create an invitation. And the invitation goes like this. I have an issue. I'd like your help in dealing with. Your help in working through. So you create, first of all, an invitation. You're inviting this person to participate in communication with you. And if you're feeling disconnected, if you're feeling fear, if you're feeling some kind of hostility, this can be a great place to actually make a physical connection with the person that you're communicating with. So that might look like, you know, I've really got some fear about talking about what's going on for me, and what I'd like to do is just join hands with you and just connect with you for a minute and create a safe space for us to communicate in. Would you do that with me? And by simply making that physical connection, you can open a whole different space in relationship and diffuse a lot of old hostility and fear. How many have ever been in a situation where you've had a conflict and you communicate about your conflict and a couple of weeks later you find out that they were talking about a totally different situation than you were? Anybody had that happen? Well, responsibility communication means that you're going to take responsibility for making sure that you're both talking about the same situation. So the second step in this process is to identify, this is step two, the objective situation. So objective observation. And here, you want to identify the situation, not your perception of it, not the output of your mind, but the actual mechanical situation. So you identify the situation, not your perception about it. It's an important distinction because here you're just making sure that everybody's talking about the same mechanical situation. And the way that you do that is you describe the mechanical facts. So what can a camera take a picture of? And what can a tape recorder record? And of course, if you're in a situation where there's a conflict, there are two people involved in the conflict, you want to make sure that both of you are described in these mechanical facts. So you include yourself in the description of the situation. So when you give people the mechanical facts, it's what actually happened rather than your mind's thoughts about what happened. There's a place in this process, it's the next step, for your thoughts about it, but at this point, it's just for the sake of identification. You're identifying the situation that you're dealing with here. And so let's use an example using this step. Let's take an example. And I'm going to set up a scenario. Let's imagine that you're sitting at home quietly reading a book. You've worked today. You came home from work. You sat down. You made yourself a cup of tea, and you're reading a book quietly in the front room. I come in the room, and I do a behavior. And what I'm going to do, and I'll ask you to communicate loudly enough so I'll be able to hear you, I'm going to ask you to just describe, using step two, the objective facts, the mechanical facts of the situation. Okay? Would you do that? So I'm not in the scene. You're sitting in the front room. And I want you to describe the situation. Okay? What just happened?
He was
dreaming. Okay. What else?
Violently.
Can a camera take a picture of violent?
Just a minute.
Can a camera take a picture of violent? Can, from one frame of a camera. Here's my arm in the air. Can you tell anything about violent? So that's your thought about it. Now, what you're telling me when you say violent is that if you did that behavior, that would be violent for you. But if you try to convince me that that reality in your mind is true about me, we're probably going to have an end of our communication because you're going to arouse my who's in there with me. And if I'm the least bit defensive, we're finished in our communication. And remember that your goal here is to get the reality in your mind intact into my mind. To do that responsibly means you're going to have to be responsible for the output of your mind. A camera can't take a picture of violent here. Make sense? So I threw the eraser, yes. And then someone else said?
You had a mad look on your face.
I had a mad look on my face. Now, can the camera from one frame of the picture, can you tell whether I was mad or whether I just got the news that I won the lottery? Can you tell? Can't do it. Mad, what you're telling me is if you had that look on your face, that would mean that you were mad. But you know something? The fact that that's what it means for you doesn't necessarily mean that that's what it means for me. And your job, I would offer in communicating, is not to try to convince somebody else that your reality, the output of your mind, is true about them. The objective of the communication is to just get your reality intact into their mind. So you might be able to say, my lips were downturned. Camera can take a picture of that. That's a mechanical fact. But when you interpret it as mad, you're telling me something that's not objective. At this stage, we just want the objective facts. Does that make sense? Okay. Anybody else? What just happened?
You left a mark on the board.
I left a mark on the board. Okay.
I made a loud noise.
Okay. Anything else? Anything else that needs to go into the picture to use step two in describing what just unfolded?
You walked away without picking it up.
I walked away without picking it up. Okay. I dispelled the piece. Can a camera take a picture of that? Can a tape recorder record that? No, no. That's not a mechanical fact. That doesn't belong at this stage in the communication. You know, what you're telling me is something went on inside of you as a result of what took place. But you're not going to get very far in pretending that's a mechanical fact because it's not. At this stage, we just want to identify the mechanical facts of the situation so everybody's talking about the same situation. There's one other piece that's missing in using step two. Anybody know what it is?
You didn't say anything.
I didn't say anything, right? What else?
You put your hands in your pockets.
I put my hands in my pockets? More important than those things, though. Remember we said, you know, if there's an issue here you want to communicate about, it's going to be really hard for you to convince me that you're doing responsibility communication when you tell me all about me and you're not involved.
You didn't talk to me.
Okay. But you haven't involved yourself yet. The mechanical facts include, gee, I was sitting in the front room reading a book. Now you're involved in the situation. If you've got a conflict with somebody, and your mechanical facts are all about them and what they did, you're not going to get very far in doing responsible communication. You need to involve yourself in it. So in essence, the mechanical facts are, I was sitting in the front room reading a book. You came in. I noticed you had a chalkboard eraser in your hand. You threw it, and it hit the whiteboard. You put your hand in your pocket. You turned around, and your lips were downturned. They were the mechanical facts. That's all. Does that make sense for this stage? And again, there's room for the issue and your perceptual reality, but at this point, we just want to get the situation identified so that we're both talking about the same thing. Okay? Then comes step three, and in step three, you get to the subjective observations. And here is where you start to describe the content of your mind. You identify your thoughts and feelings, and you do it with words that reflect your awareness that you are describing your reality. For instance, the one about you shattered the peace. You know, if somebody's the least bit sensitive, they're probably going to feel like, you mean I'm to blame here? And that will tend to shut down communication faster than anything. But if that was your issue, then the description would go something like this. Now, I have an issue that I'd really like to communicate about. I've got a little bit of fear about it. I'd like to connect with you, and I'd like to be able to clean it up. And last night, I was sitting in the front room, you know, having a cup of tea and reading a book, and you came in. You had a chalkboard eraser in your hand. You threw it and hit the whiteboard. You left a mark on the board, it fell to the floor, you put your hand in your pocket, you turned around, your lips seemed to be downturned, and I felt like my peace had been shattered. Now what you just did is you took responsibility for the fact that your peace was shattered. Instead of blaming me, now if I'm sensitive, I might say, well, I didn't do anything to shatter your peace, what are you talking about? So, no, I'm not saying you shattered my peace, I'm just saying that's what went on inside of me. And I'm willing to own that that's what happened for me. And what I want to do is I want you to understand what was going on for me in that situation. Or maybe it was, gee, you know, when I saw you come in the room and do that, I thought that you were angry.